Suspect Convictions is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/suspect to get started today.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911,
what's your emergency? I need
ambulance.
My daughter's dying. I think
a rescue is needed.
3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Christina,
it's Christina. He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
It's Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern. In June of 1998 in Bloomington, Illinois, 3-year-old Christina McNeil was found dead in her home by her father, who was later convicted of murdering his daughter. Barton McNeil has served 19 years of his sentence at a maximum security prison in southern Illinois. The day of Christina's death, Barton was floating an alternate suspect to authorities, the woman with whom he had just ended a relationship. McNeil said the girlfriend had forcibly entered Christina's bedroom, cutting a screen in the window, entering the room, then suffocating the girl to death. That girlfriend, Masuk Wang, is now serving time for murdering her mother-in-law more than a decade after Christina's death. Supporters of Barton McNeil and the Illinois Innocence Project say there's enough evidence to reopen the case. Prosecutors say the right man remains imprisoned for the girl's death. Illinois-based investigative journalist Scott Reeder, originator of Suspect Convictions, is examining the evidence in this case. Last week, Scott, we listened to the 911 calls that Barton McNeil made the morning he found his daughter. This case remains unsolved, according to many. Even local prosecutors who weren't on the job 20 years ago have been studying it closely. Why all of this attention now?
Well, Masuk Wang is in prison right now for murdering somebody else. And she was who Barton McNeil was pointing his finger at the day of the murder. And the question is, did she commit the murder? The Illinois Innocence Project contends that she did. By the way, I reached out to Masuk, sent her a letter asking for an interview. I haven't heard anything back from her.
The Illinois Innocence Project is not only advocating reopening this case, they're also expected to file some motions for some hearings that could introduce new evidence that was not heard at Barton McNeil's original trial, which was a bench trial, led by a public defender.
Yes.
Scott, you've talked to many people in connection with this case as you look at some of the evidence. One of them is a member of the Illinois Innocence Project, John Hanlon. Talk a little bit about what you learned from Hanlon as you discuss this with him.
Well, John is very passionate about this case. He's a veteran defense attorney. He's somebody that fully acknowledges most people who are in prison belong there. He's somebody who tends to be very, very cautious about claims of innocence. I mean, he goes at it very judiciously with ones cases that he chooses to represent. And he is very passionate that Barton McNeil is innocent in this case. And both he and his partner, Gwen Jordan, are pushing hard to have this case reviewed in a new trial.
This case is a priority for us for one reason, because we're absolutely certain that Barton McNeil is innocent of this crime. Let's start with the motive. The motive was that Bart had supposedly sexually assaulted her. He was up late at night on the internet and then needed to satisfy himself, so he sexually assaulted his daughter. That's the supposed motive. And then further, that he then decided, oh, well, I'll have to kill her because she might tell somebody. So the body then, of course, then is found in the bed. Now, if you're concerned about evidence being located that might peg you for a sexual assault, you sure don't leave the body in the bed for investigators to later find the body and find evidence which would indicate what had happened. It doesn't make sense. Now, if the body had been disposed of, that might be a different story. We've heard about cases like that. But it makes absolutely no sense that Bart McNeil would kill his child because he had sexually assaulted her, but then leave the body there. It doesn't make sense. The artifacts of the body, which the pathologist at the time said were indicators of sexual assault, are, in fact, not indicators of sexual assault. There's been some new developments in the science in the last 20 years, which make it really clear that the, for example, swollen orifice, that's not an example or an artifact of sexual assault. That's part of the death process. That's just one example. So there is, I think at the end of the day, a judge is going to be really hard-pressed to say anything but this was not a sexual assault situation.
We do expect the Illinois Innocence Project to be filing some motions yet this fall, and we'll be tracking those here on suspect convictions. Scott Reeder, you also spoke with members of the state's attorney's office in McLean County. Now, these people were not in office 20 years ago when the case was originally tried and a conviction was found against Barton McNeil. You talked to Mary Cole from the state's attorney's office and state's attorney Jason Chambers.
You know, and I liked both of them, and I think they're very sharp, honest individuals. I think they are very committed to reviewing this case. They did a thorough review of the case, and they're very much convinced that Barton McNeil is guilty.
As I read through the file, and I did have a completely open mind and read through it very objectively, because I believed, based on what I know about my boss, Jason Chambers, that if I thought that there was any reason to doubt Mr. McNeil's innocence, I knew that my boss would back me up. So as I read through it with an open mind and objectively, I became convinced that the conviction was correct.
So if there was a murder and it was not Barton McNeil who perpetrated it, who was it? And how did they get in there? Mary Cole says it goes against common sense to believe that McNeil's girlfriend, Masuk, would have likely made such an attempt as McNeil alleges.
From a common sense perspective, it would make no sense for this woman who had been in a relationship with Mr. McNeil, would have been familiar with his habits and the layout of his residence. It would have made no sense for her to just blindly enter the room that he knows that she sleeps in, that he sleeps in. There would have been no way that we know of, or no way that the defendant has suggested, that she would have known that he wasn't in bed in that room at the time she entered. So it would have been an extremely risky, unusual decision for someone to make. So yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
But McNeil says there's an explanation. And Scott, he laid it out to you in a recent phone call from Menard Correctional Center. Barton says Masuk called him at about 10:30 that night to ask if Christina was there and where would she be sleeping. But since Barton frequently slept in the same bed as Christina, that still leaves some room for doubt. McNeil has an explanation for that, too.
Well, the Venetian blinds were down. There's a few inches in which you can peek through the Venetian blinds and see that I was sitting at the computer right in front of the two front windows, underneath which was all this trampled foliage. This is why I always thought that trampled foliage beneath the front windows was noteworthy, was because it, from that vantage point, somebody could see that I was not asleep or in bed, that I was sitting at my computer, the light was on, and the TV was probably on, and yes, the blinds were pulled, but it was not completely impossible to see, you know, through the gap between the blinds and the perimeter of the window, to see that the light was on, and I'm sitting there at the computer. And the cook knew my hand well enough to know that I don't normally go to bed early, and I do spend a lot of time at the computer, and usually until after midnight. So it would have been easy for her, especially if she was not alone, as I'm sure she wasn't, to recognize that I was not, you know, in bed, asleep. You know, on top of that, just as likely to have slept on the couch as in the bed, or had Christina sleep on the couch and me in the bed. As it happens, she knew that Christina was in the bedroom because she had called me approximately 2 hours prior to when I believe this murder occurred, specifically asking me, you know, whether I had Christina, what she was doing, and where she was sleeping.
So if you accept the premise, as alleged by Barton McNeil, that Masuk had the knowledge and confidence to break into the bedroom, the next step is to closely examine the window evidence, which investigators did upon returning to the apartment the night of June 16, 1998. Now, there are three key aspects of the window worth taking a closer look at, Scott Reeder. One is that there were some cuts to the window screen near the latches where the screen would open. We discussed that a bit in episode one. Another is, was the screen tightly in place in the window? Because that's key as to whether the window was forced open and if someone left the scene. And the third thing are some spider webs that showed up along the windowsill and also by the screen. This is key because prosecutors say the existence of spider webs proves that the window had not been tampered with, at least for about a 24-hour period. So let's take a look at each one of these. First of all, look at the spider web.
Mary Cole, with the McLean County State's Attorney's Office, has a very definite opinion about the significance of these spider webs in the window and along the sill. This is what she had to say.
That's something that's already been litigated and has been found to not undercut the judge's verdict in this case. I just think that it's one piece of the puzzle, and it's one thing that goes to the common sense argument that what he's suggesting happened here simply could not have.
The defense contends that there's a fallacy in the this argument. In fact, they consulted with a top entomologist in the United States, Todd Blackledge, at the University of Akron in Ohio, who has made his career studying spider webs. One of the questions is how quickly can a spider spin a web?
So it really depends on the kind of web that you're talking about. So the kind of classic orb web that you see on all the Halloween decorations this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Once the spider has established where it's going to build that web, it can be produced in as little as a half hour to an hour. So that can be a really quick web to build. And spiders will build that web each day, take it down, and then build a new one on a daily basis. Other kinds of webs, like the cobwebs that you see in your basement, or maybe the funnel webs that you see on the bushes or the lawn in the morning dew, those webs are typically built over a period of several days, although, again, it only takes the spider a single night to really establish the web. Then they add to it night after night.
In this particular case, the prosecution, even to this day, they allege that the spider webs had been in place for a long time at this window, and therefore the break-in could not have occurred as the defense alleges occurred. What they say is that, in part, the spider web also contains some dead insects, which means that this had been there for a long time. Is that necessarily the case?
It's not absolutely necessarily the case. The spider builds a web that's perfectly capable of catching prey in a single night and can catch and consume small insects pretty rapidly. Now, that said, I did see some rather grainy video footage of the webs that the prosecution's talking about on the windowsill. And they did look like they were probably pretty old, but they also looked like they were a bit damaged. And at the end of the day, I couldn't ascertain from that video footage whether they were actually connected to the screen of the window that would have had to have been removed for somebody to come into the window, or if they were just connected to the frame around that screen.
You've seen the pictures. You referred to the grainy video and that. In some of that video, there is it looks like a linear spider web that goes from the window to the wood frame there. It's maybe several inches, and it's perpendicular to the window sill, I guess. Is that the kind of something that can be webbed by a spider in a short amount of time, or is that likely something days or weeks?
Definitely not days or weeks. It could well have persisted for that long, but that web was either a cobweb or a funnel web. I can't quite tell from the video, but both of them have that kind of sheet-like appearance to them. And the initial web will be built in a single night. It's just then the spider will add to it through time and repair damage as it catches food and so forth.
Do you have any way of ascertaining by looking at that video how old those spider webs were?
My guess is that they are more than a day old, just because they look pretty conspicuous. The silk in a fresh web is typically a couple of microns in diameter, so that's, you know, 50 to 100 times skinnier than your hair. So it's very hard to see. That web showed up pretty well. It looked like it was maybe covered with dust. But again, I don't know enough about what was done during the investigation. It's possible that police were using dust for fingerprints or something, or anything like that. So there's just a lot of ambiguity there. I would not feel comfortable saying that that web precludes the possibility that that window screen was opened that night. I need more information.
What I'm hearing from you is it's hard to tell what happened there, but the fact that there was a spider web there doesn't mean that somebody didn't break into that room that night through that window.
Correct. That's the best conclusion we can come to with the evidence at hand.
That's Todd Blackledge, an entomologist at the University of Akron in Ohio. It's Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern, along with Illinois-based veteran investigative journalist Scott Reeder. We're examining the death of Christina McNeil, a three-year-old girl in Bloomington, Illinois, nearly 20 years ago during Suspect Convictions.
Folks, I've been hiring people for the last 20-some years. It's difficult. I've interviewed so many candidates that I liked, but then found out were really bad matches once they came to work for me. And I missed some really quality people who applied, but just didn't have the right thing on the resume that they could have put on there. It's really difficult to hire the right person for the right job. That's why I like ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. And you can get over 100 postings out there on the internet. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting so they receive the best possible matches. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/suspect. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/suspect.
Scott, not only were there the spider webs along the window, but there were some cuts in the screen that we've talked about previously that Barton says were key to a forced entry. Talk about that.
Barton says that he did not discover the cuts in the screen until the afternoon that Christina's body was found. As you'll recall, Willis, originally police, the paramedics, folks who responded to the scene assumed this was a natural cause of death. Bart came back to his apartment that afternoon after finding the body that morning and was examining the room, and one of the things he found was the window fan was down on the floor. That didn't surprise him because when the police and paramedics were there earlier in the day, they had seen that. But then he looked at the screen, and he said, and he found two cuts in the screen right above the levers where you push to unhook the screen from the windowsill. And they're in places where somebody, if they could cut them, they could reach in with their fingers and operate those levers and open up the screen.
And he called 911 and pleaded with authorities to please come out and check this scene.
My name is Bart McNeil. My daughter was found dead by me this morning. The detectives were here. The coroner told me everything. I need a homicide detective. Please. I believe the detective here might have been from homicide. I don't know. I think the detective comes when there's the death of a person where the cause is undetermined. I have reason to believe now that I am convinced that she was murdered, and I need a detective here immediately.
Okay.
I don't know if they saw this or not, but I just discovered it myself.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
I'll get him out for you.
Thank you. Bye.
So police eventually come out to the scene. It's nighttime at this point, and they decide to take the entire window out of its wooden frame. And when they're doing this, the screen falls out. And it raises the question, was the screen ever in there securely?
And it falls out in such a manner that it kind of surprises the police detective who's removing that. And this was caught on video.
Yes, it was. Well, we're going to play the audio of that video for you as the police officer is examining the evidence, starting to lift the frame of this window out of the wooden frame. And then we hear this.
This shows the lock on the screen, the hole in that side of the window screen, and also cobwebs attached from the window frame to the screen itself.
Screen came loose.
Damn it.
So, Willis, what do you make of this screen not being securely into the window frame? Does that seem significant to you?
Well, I think it does, because if the screen is securely in place in the window, it's not going to come loose when the detective is carefully pulling it out. And you can see on the video, and you can even hear it, you can hear the audio as we just did. But when you look at the video and you can see it on the website, the policeman is very carefully moving the frame, and then the window, the screen pops loose, which indicates that it was not securely in place, which means that someone could have, upon exiting the apartment and the bedroom, have jerry-rigged some sort of a setup where that screen appears to be in the window. And that looks to me like that could have happened that way.
Here's what doesn't make any sense to me, Willis. Okay, if you're the intruder and you come through that window and you suffocate this little girl in her bed, I can understand going back out that window because you don't want to run into the father in the other room. But what doesn't make any sense to me is, why would you take the trouble to take that screen and put it back into place?
Why not just leave the screen open and just get the heck out of there?
Exactly. Right? So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that if you're going to premeditate this situation where you're going to break into a house, you're going to bring a ladder or a bucket or something, you're going to try to get into the window, you're going to be careful, you're going to look around, you're going to make sure that this scene is secure and you think you can get in the dark of the night. If you're going to take the time to do all that, then you're going to be careful about how you leave, because you just leave that window wide open. It creates instant evidence to anyone who walks in the room that, hey, this room was broken into and this girl was murdered. If you put the screen back in place, then what you're doing is you're kind of sealing the scene, at least to some degree. And apparently it wasn't obvious to Barton McNeil, because he didn't even realize this until later in the day that the window had been broken into, at least according to his theory. So right there, it proves that she was successful in making the scene look less like a murder scene.
The other thing that strikes me is everybody in the case agrees that when the paramedics and the police officers and the firefighters and everybody got to the crime scene that morning when they thought it was just a natural cause of death. One thing they all noticed was a window fan on the floor. Okay, if you are going to take the trouble of putting the screen back in place, why wouldn't you have messed with the window fan as well? What do you think, Willis?
You can't possibly do that from the outside. If you're going to put the screen back in the window, you can't secure the fan first and then do the screen later. It's not going to work that way. The fan has to be in place after the window is secure. So you can't do both if you're operating from the outside. That's the way I look at it.
I guess you could look at it that way. I mean, it just struck me as odd that somebody might have taken the trouble to have put the screen back in, although not real securely, but at least gotten it back in there, but it left the window fan on the floor. I mean, I guess if what would seem logical to me was be, you know, just would escape out the open window and just leave everything behind. Obviously, the window fan was on the floor, but maybe that wasn't a possibility, how they went about doing it.
Another contributing factor to why the prosecution believes that Barton McNeil committed this crime is the assertion made by Mary Cole in her interview with you from the state's attorney's office that the weather played a part in what happened at the scene.
There had been a thunderstorm and rain overnight the night that Christina was killed, yet there was no mud or footprints outside the window. There was no evidence of mud, footprints, drops, any type of moisture that had come from outside within the residence or around the window or anywhere.
Willis, I reached out to a high school friend who's now a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and I had him pull the weather data for that month back 20-some years ago. And they got about a little less than an inch the day before and the day of the murder, so almost 2 inches of rain. Of course, there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is there's a concrete sidewalk outside of that window, so they wouldn't necessarily have had somebody standing right in the grass, especially if they used a ladder or a bucket or something like that to stand on. But the other thing that comes to my mind is, okay, a child's found dead the next morning, and all these first responders are racing to save this child. You got the paramedics rolling in there with a stretcher, and they're carrying all their equipment. You got the police officers getting there. You've got the firefighters getting there. You've got the coroner's people there. Guess what? There's no mud or grass tracked in by any of them in there, and you would expect that. There's bedlam going on in that bedroom. And then when they took pictures of the scene, they didn't find any mud or grass. So why would you expect an intruder to have left mud or grass in the room if all of those first responders coming in hadn't done it?
I guess it could be a timing of when the rain fell, I suppose. If it was pouring down rain at the instant that this intruder was supposedly gaining entrance into the home, you could say, well, maybe there should be mud then. Maybe it had dried up by the morning. Nobody really knows what the timing was of all that rainfall.
And we don't know how saturated the ground was at that time either. I mean, you know, I've seen an inch of rainfall and the grass still looks pretty dry and it just got absorbed right away into the ground. And I've seen an inch of rainfall and, you know, you've had 6 inches of rain already that week and it just sits there on top and makes everything muddy. So it's a little hard to discern just how much saturation there was and a lot of other things.
One of the reasons the McLean County State Attorney's Office is currently interested in taking a look at some of the facts of this case, as you discovered, Scott, when you went to interview Jason Chambers, is that they have found some evidence that allegedly links Barton McNeil to the death of Christina McNeil. Allegedly, there had been some sexual abuse that had gone on.
I talked to Jason Chambers, the McLean County State's Attorney, about this. And this is what he had to say about it.
One of the things that stood out to us was the confirmation of the sexual abuse that had occurred. That's a significant piece of it because the alternate theory that's being proposed doesn't explain that.
Did Barton McNeil sexually abuse his daughter, then kill her to cover it up? That's how prosecutors successfully convinced a judge who convicted McNeil during a bench trial. We'll take a closer look at the sexual assault allegations aspect of Christina McNeil's death next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of GLT Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kerr. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions. Thank you.
One-third of all murder cases in America remain open. Each one is called a cold case, and only 1% are ever solved. Cold Case Files, the podcast, tells these stories of the cases that seemed unsolvable, but then eventually something breaks. Based on the iconic documentary series on A&E, Cold Case Files, the podcast, is hosted by Brooke Gittings of Convicted and Actual Innocence, and also features the voice of the original series host, Bill Curtis. You can find new episodes of Cold Case Files, a podcast, every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts.